It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome, B5 fans, to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks, and with me are Tim Callender.
Greetings, everyone.
And Jeffrey Willers.
Hi, guys. I'm out here with 145,000 of my best friends on the 405 freeway tonight.
Also, you're glad we're talking tonight so you can get distracted from those crazy people.
No distractions here. I'm totally focused on the job at hand.
Well, today we have an interview with...
Well, obviously the job at hand... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oops. This is not going to be fun. We have an interview with prop fabricator Bear Burge and a little bit of discussion about Season 1, Episode 1, Midnight on the Firing Line.
Well, that spoiled the surprise.
Is it... We can't surprise everyone every time.
That's what I was going to try to do.
Oh.
We've ruined your fun, Jeff.
It's okay. It's your show, Summer.
We should save the surprises for the really big guests.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Bear Burge isn't a big guest?
Don't tell him.
We see his work, but we don't feel his pain when we see his character getting stomped. There's a difference.
Fair enough.
I just want you guys to know I'm never going to tell you who the guest is.
That's fair. That's fair. I can live with that.
So can I.
Okay, pause.
So let's get started with Midnight on the Firing Line.
All right. You want to lead us in with that?
You want to try to sum it up?
I guess not. I guess I'm going to be leading us in with that.
Okay.
Midnight on the Firing Line, first episode of Season 1, which actually aired 9 months after the pilot. The best way to sum this up is throw everybody into a blender and see who survives.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that. I think that this show, even more so than the pilot, establishes the tone of Babylon 5. I think there's a lot of rough edges to it, but it also gives you a sense initially of who is doing what to whom.
That's Midnight on the Firing Line is different in the who does what to whom, because in the pilot, the Narn and the Centauri weren't nipping at each other's throats. In the Midnight on the Firing Line, things have changed. They're actively growling at each other.
And Jakar is much more of an antagonistic figure in this one. Not only is he and Londo squaring off, but some of the antipathy that was established in the gathering carries over between Jakar and Sinclair.
Yes, yes. That was definitely a clearer carryover. What I thought was interesting was more of how Londo's behavior changed from the pilot to this episode. He was more resigned, reserved, and in this one he's more... He's angry about what happened, first of all. Angry that it was his nephew who's being used as a political pawn, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And I think we see, you know, a little bit of that, I guess, seeing his family honor being tweaked as being one of the catalysts which drives him down the road, which we see him on the rest of the series.
I think what's also interesting is you also get the initial sense of the impotence of his character, the frustration that he knows he's in a place where things are going to be happening, but he also is, at this point, incapable of making anything happen. You witness his ploy with not telling the council and the League of Non-Aligned Worlds about the Centaurum's decision not to do anything, trying to force a vote to help out. And of course, Shakaar sees through that ruse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Londo's left holding the bag, as it were. And then takes it upon himself to try to go assassinate Shakaar, at which point Garibaldi steps in to prevent him from doing that. But you do get, definitely get a sense of a character who is powerless in a very real way.
And has already begun to take steps to alleviate that feeling. He doesn't want to feel powerless anymore. He laments what the Centauri Empire used to be, and that makes him susceptible to, shall we say, later temptations.
Absolutely. The other thing that I think is interesting that sets a tone that continues through at least to the second year, when the attack on Ragash 3 is first discovered, and nobody knows, at least on the station, who's responsible, there's the scene where Londo confronts Shakaar in the council chamber and says, "You know nothing of this," and Shakaar says, "Well, I'm as surprised as you." And then, of course, later on, when it's revealed that the Narn did attack and they meet in the Zocalo, Londo comes to him and says, "You knew the whole time," and Shakaar says, "No, I just found out about it, but I'm pretty happy that it happened." And that echoes down the line as we go forward with the season.
Jeff, do you have any comments?
Actually, midnight is after my bedtime, so I don't remember much of this.
Fair enough.
Well, I think it's important to note that this is also marks an important appearance of Kosh, in that the mystery of what's inside the suit is hammered home. There's the scene, of course, where Sinclair goes to Kosh's quarters to see if he's going to show up at the council chamber for the vote, and he sees the encounter suit sort of hanging there limply. Here's the whoosh, and something rushes by, and then it becomes animate again. And I just sat there when I first saw it, just wondering, you know, what was that?
How much longer did it go before it started to make sense to you what that was?
Honestly, Jeffrey, it took until Fall of Night, the end of year two, when something, anyways, comes out of Kosh's encounter suit. The thing for me, and maybe this was my own preconception, I went into it, and immediately my connection with Kosh comes from the Lensman series with the character of Nadrik. He was this entity who lived on frigid worlds, breathed methane or whatever else, I can't remember what Doc Smith had, but was always seen in an encounter suit because he couldn't, you know, meet with the human characters in any other fashion. And I was just thrilled because to me, this was Nadrik. He was a major character, had completely alien thought processes. You didn't know what he was looking like. Apparently, he needed some sort of gaseous atmosphere to breathe because all the human characters who went to visit him showed up wearing the breather masks. So, you know, maybe I was blinded by my own preconceptions, but that's pretty much where I was with Kosh.
And I think I'm on the opposite spectrum. I always assumed Kosh was a being of light. You know, he was had more energy form than a carbon form. And I guess I was expecting more, a deeper explanation, because what was in the pilot was sort of contradictory to that, I guess, assumption, that theory, from what we saw later. But I'm glad they did it the way they did it later.
Right.
Well, when you saw Kosh in Midnight on the firing line, your expectation was that he was going to behave like other ambassadors when he was confronted by Sinclair?
No, not at all. That was, for me, one of the things that was really exciting, was that you witnessed the exchange. You know, I guess maybe it's a second one where Sinclair is looking at the viewer that Kosh is looking at, or asks him, you know, how do you feel about the Centauri and the Narns? And Kosh's response is, "They are a dying race. We should let them pass." That hinted at completely alien thought processes. And I hadn't, you know, there was no idea of how this particular character was going to respond to any given situation, and I loved that. And it was a great counterpoint to the other ambassadors. You know, as alien as Jakar appears, and as different as, or rather, as Garibaldi says, appearances aside, the Centauri have nothing in common with us. You know, they were obviously representative of human emotions, or the human experience, if you will. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the fact that Kosh was just so different all the way down, not only the encountered suit, but just his responses, the cryptic nature of his actions, that was, as I said before, that was the big hook for me initially. That's one of the reasons I really love this episode.
Summer, did you find that Sinclair's agenda was clear to you? Did you understand who he was as a character?
I don't think I got a really, really good feel for Sinclair until later. What's the episode? Ha. Looking at my cheat sheet. by any means.
Sorry,
no. By a little bit we saw in Mind War, and then By Any Means Necessary was one I was trying to remember. By Any Means Necessary, I think, is the first time where you go, okay, this guy really, really does things his way when he needs to. But I didn't get that in the early episodes.
I think generally the problems that this episode has are with the human characters. The aliens all seemed, if not fully formed, Straczynski certainly had a better handle on what was driving those characters. But I think that, you know, Sinclair was just kind of there. You know, they were establishing his character. Ivanova was almost completely unlikable. You know, it's understandable with her reaction when Talia shows up, because that's explained at the end of the episode, mm-hmm. the deal with her mother and Sycor. But the scene where Garibaldi's at her station trying to figure out how the Raiders are finding out which ships to hit, and the first thing she says to him is there a reason you're using my station, or should I just break your hands off at the wrists? If you were at your job and somebody came up to you and said that to you, how blasé would you be? I mean, and as obviously as the series goes on, you know, you get a better sense of her character, that she's driven. But that's just, you know, that's not driven. That's just plain rude.
Well, I think his reaction to that statement, just, you know, blowing it off mostly, says a lot about their relationship. Because you see them playing pranks on each other later.
Right, and I guess that's true, but I think really it boils down to that either Straczynski didn't quite have a handle at that early stage of the game of what he was doing with the human characters. And remember, Ivanova especially is a new character. Mm-hmm. She was not seen in the pilot. And how much of that might be the actors, too, also trying to get a sense of what they're doing with their roles. So these were, you know, first-time major roles for both Claudia Christian and Jerry Doyle. So I think, you know, there's a certain, you know, trying to get it, your feet under your ground. But, you know, having said that, I think those are places where the episode doesn't quite come together.
I guess for me, what I saw was more refereeing, like the humans were being referees between the Narn and the Centauri, and they were also... It looked like they were still tiptoeing around the Minbari. They weren't sure, like, okay, yeah, the war is over, but how do we know what I say next isn't going to start it back up again?
Right.
That's the feel I got.
For me, it's as if season one starts out almost mid-conversation, as if Joe had already been telling the story, and then all of a sudden we as viewers were, like, thrown into the conversation. And had the disadvantage of having to try and pick up on the pace and understand who everybody was and what their interactions were.
Well, I don't mind that so much, and that was one of the initial intriguing factors for me. You know, the jump points opening, there was no explanation. You had to kind of get your head around the fact that this was going to be a different way of getting from point A to point B. That was kind of neat, using the links and PPGs and the way that, the general universe was structured. And that's fine. I think that, the alien characters there's a better idea of what was happening with them initially, and not so much with the human characters.
I guess for me, I liked it, the way it just kind of threw you in the middle of a story. From a pure storytelling perspective, it's good because you're thrown into this situation. Literally, you walk into a door, there's a party going on, people are living their lives. It's not like you see these people, these lives, these people had lives before you walked in the room, and their lives will continue after you walk out of the room. We're just dropped in to observe a particular segment, and that's where it just happened to start. I don't mind the catching up. It's just that it seemed like it took 5 episodes longer than it should have to help everybody catch up.
Listen, my battery's about to run low, so I'll catch up with you guys next episode, okay?
All righty. Yeah,
thanks, Jeff. We appreciate your time.
All right. Carry on.
Now, I will say some of the things that I really enjoyed dialogue-wise in Midnight in the Firing Line is the scene in the Zen Garden with Sinclair and Jakar discussing about the upcoming vote, and Jakar is talking about how humans and Narn are really not so different after all, but not recognizing that Sinclair is a man of higher principles and is willing to go to some lengths to stay with those, to make those principles work.
Mm-hmm.
And, I like the little bit where they were get to talking about the Narn and the Centauri wanting to wipe each other out, and Jakar saying, "Oh, I confess that I, will be happy once we can carve Centauri bones into flutes for children. It's a dream I have." And Sinclair gives him a wry smile and says, "Be careful, Ambassador, because not every dream I've heard ends well for you." And I thought that was kind of clever. I liked that a lot.
Yeah. I guess I lost my train of thought. ran out of the room.
Some are in terms of dominoes that are set up here for later on. What for you are the ones that you now look back at, having seen all 5 years of Babylon 5, and you go back to Midnight on the Firing Line and go, "Oh, that's what he meant."
I guess seeing that he put Talia and Susan in that opposition, and like 1 minute they're conflicting with each other, the next they're actually almost commiserating with each other. That sort of give and take that sets up things in, what is it, third season?
Actually, mid-second season with Divided Loyalties, where Talia is
right.
Written out of the show.
Yes, but, well, yeah. It seems like that thread was dropped there right at the beginning. Garibaldi, I guess, seeing his little rant when he was talking to Londo.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Something like, it goes like, I know it burns. I know the things it makes you want to do. Seeing that little, I know how that feels, and I will get even with you thing. That sort of resonates with him later. I guess seeing that the Narn kicked over the Centauri anthill at the wrong moment. I mean, it's like,
right.
it seemed like up until that point, they had just been building their forces and building their forces. And the only things on their mind was getting revenge from what the Centauri did them to them 100 years earlier. And
right.
I don't think it was clear to me until later that how old Jakar was, because he said he was a child during the Centauri occupation later on.
Right.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. If the Centauri invaded Narn 100 years ago, how long was it when they left? Did they just leave like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago?
No, I'm going back and watching the series. I don't recall off the top of my head. I got the sense that, it was about a 100 years ago that they got booted off. I think that
not booted
Jakar
off.
Jakar and Londo.
Not booted off, but started. Like it started right. 100 years ago and ended 50 years ago. Because there was, what was it? I'm trying to remember the timeline. They were talking about Deathwalker having occurred right. 30 years or 20 years before the Earth-Mimbari War. Is that correct? Do I have my fact right?
That sounds about right. I'll have to go back and double check that. I can't remember off the top of my head. It was right after the Dilgar War, so that would be about 20 years before the Earth-Mimbari War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 30 years before our current timeline. And if we're wrong, right. I'm sure the fans will let us know. So you've got 30 years there. So the Centauri had to have left Narn 50 years ago. So Jakar is, we don't know how old Jakar is.
Right.
At least it's not stated in the series how old he is at that time. Using that time frame, trying to figure out what the Narn were using that 30, 40 years just to build up their forces to hit back at the Centauri. Only their timing couldn't have been worse because the Shadows were looking for somebody to help them pick a fight. And just seeing how that first incident, you know, the first incident we see opening at the beginning of the first episode set up everything for the next 4 years.
Right. And I think that other than Londo's dream, which of course culminates in his and Jakar's death, I think what's established here is less dominoes that fall over and more the situations that become that evolve and change over time. You know, you've got Jakar, who's much more antagonistic, and the Narn, like you said, have kicked over the anthill. The Centauri are fading people, and they're, you know, Londo's drowning himself in drink, trying to recall the great days, the glory days of the Empire. And how much that changes over the course of the series. It radical isn't quite the right word, but it all gets turned on its head. You know, the Narn kick over the anthill, and they're the ones ends up getting crushed halfway through the season by the Centauri. And the Centauri who are downtrodden, of course, you know, made a Faustian pact with the Shadows, but they're suddenly the most fearsome force in the galaxy, at least as far as anyone can tell who's not working behind the scenes. And that, you know, you go back and you look at it and you just see where that sort of thing was set up and how much changed over time. I think that's just a magic thing. Okay, any further thoughts on Midnight on the Firing Line?
Nope.
I'll say one last thing. One of the things that I did like with our first views really in action of the Star Furies. And again, one of the things that I liked is you had spaceships behaving like spaceships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were using vectored thrust and, you know, you could be going in one direction, but sure, swing the ship around the other way to bring the guns to bear. And that was really neat to see. Plus people in real life spacesuits. That was kind of novel. You know, Star Trek had pretty much avoided spacesuits. The one time you ever saw them, they were pretty cheesy, and here were guys wearing real-life space helmets and real-life spacesuits and real-life spaceships, and I really, really dug that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ship movements, the jump gate technology, I thought the jump gates were cool. Spacesuits, yes, humans are frail, frail creatures, and space is big, and it's mean. So we're gonna take a little break and come back with our interview right after this.
At Michael and Evo's Dragon Page, we're more than just a podcast. We're
the greatest show on earth. We've got lions, tigers, and elephants, clowns, free balloons for all the kids, to bring the whole family. We've got something for everyone.
Stop, stop, stop. What's all this about lions and tigers and elephants and free balloons? What were you thinking?
I like balloons.
We're a sci-fi and fantasy site with reviews on books and movies and author interviews.
So, no balloons?
No.
Just one?
No!
Michael and Evo's Dragon Page. Too much sci-fi goodness for one podcast to contain.
www.dragonpage.com.
We're not that kind of a circus either.
Hello.
Hey, it's Jeffrey.
Jeffrey, hey, how you doing, good sir?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
I am well, and despising my ability to play softball, but aside from that, I live to see puberty.
Well, I'll tell you what. I would like you to meet the two hosts of our show. This is Summer Brooks and Tim Callender. Tim and Summer, I want you to meet Bear Berg.
It's a pleasure to meet
Hello.
You.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing well.
Bear, go ahead and tell them who you are and what you did on Babylon 5.
Alrighty. When I was on Babylon 5, I was the prop fabricator for the show, the on-set prop fabricator, and it was my job to take the designs that would come out of the art department and basically make them into a 3D reality. Aside from a Playboy photographer, I can't think of anything else I'd rather be doing. Sorry about that.
No.
That's okay.
Dream on. That's so what
you...
I have a really unusual...
Bear, how did you land that job?
Basically, in high school and stuff, I always had a love of science fiction, and then I got into enjoying building stuff. So I kind of married the science fiction with the building stuff together and found myself in Los Angeles. And for 11 years, I worked on the Star Trek series. And at that point in time, the company I was currently with, we were having disputes, and I left there and was gainfully employed by Babylon 5, and quite happily. One opportunity I can sit back and say that I don't like to brag, but this is the one opportunity I can sit back and say that I've really had a kind of a chance to touch both sides of the sci-fi gender. Basically, we had Star Trek we were working on, and then Babylon 5. And I'll tell you, 11 years on Star Trek doesn't make up for one day on Babylon 5, because it was a whole different attitude and just a really magnificent group of people to work with.
Okay. Now, what was the first prop you actually manufactured?
The first prop I manufactured on Babylon 5, mm-hmm. or just in, let's see.
On B5.
First piece for Babylon 5. Wow. God, that's a tough one. Boy, I'll be honest, I really can't recall exactly what the first one was. I just really enjoyed the fact that I was doing it at the time. I believe, and I'm going to take a stab at this, I believe it was we were doing Ranger pikes for the Rangers. They needed a copy that they could wear in their pocket or in the pouch, and then they had a metal one that I made later on in the series. We made two metal ones, fully extended, and then the short versions that they could carry around in their pouches that show it closed.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that was the first thing I made for B5.
Cool.
What was your favorite prop to manufacture?
Oh, boy. During the filming of Third Space, they come across an alien artifact that basically is causing all this trouble, and alien races are pouring through it. They find out it's a gate. And what we did, they had to manufacture a bomb, a thermite bomb, that Sheridan puts on the actual artifact to destroy it. Unfortunately, in the series, you don't really get a chance to see all the things it did because of the amount of time. But that was actually, I think, my favorite. You would install these power rods, four of them, and they would close into the center, and when they reached the center, it would detonate. But because of time, once again, we didn't have a chance to show that feature on it.
You guys should know that poor Bear is not feeling all that great today. He let me know that he was playing softball yesterday and got whacked in the mouth, and he's lost his two front teeth, and so he's struggling just to talk to us, so we appreciate his effort.
Ow.
Yeah. So, guys, please forgive me if I'm my speech impediment right now and if I'm not speaking real loudly.
That's all right. Well, since you bring up softball, I noticed a couple episodes we had references to baseball, and in fact there's a scene I think in Knives where Sheridan and Garibaldi are taking batting practice. Mm-hmm. Was that sport prevalent amongst the cast and crew? Was that a favorite?
I know a few of the guys that played on teams outside of the show, and there were a couple of times we actually had a softball game up against the Buffy the Vampire crew. And if I remember right, I don't remember what had happened, if it was rain or something, but we ended up canceling and we never got back into the game.
You know, I can, Bear, I can expand on that a little bit. In seasons one and two, there was an active softball league that was going on between, oh my gosh, there were several TV shows that were all part of it at the same time, and there was a regular series, softball league, that was taking place amongst all the teams, and we played aggressively for two full seasons. Then in the third season, it waned a little bit, and by fourth and fifth season, I agree with you, we didn't do it near as much.
Yeah. I think by that time, everybody was more focused on just, you know, jumping on the show and everything, and everybody was busy.
What was the prop that you remember that was probably the hardest to fabricate?
The hardest to fabricate? Wow. I think mainly there were some rifles that we did up for the Centauri Palace Guards. We threw some rifles together very quickly. The reason they were such a challenge is because they were all metal, and the fact that they were basically the time we had to put them together and then get them on set. We were a little short on time, so they didn't turn out quite as happy as I was with them, but we got them done. Bit of a nightmare, but we got them done.
On average, how long did it take you to fabricate something like average-sized?
Let's see. Generally, if it would depend on the piece. If it was something like a PPG, we had metal copies that were already fabricated. By the time I had gotten there, it was a matter of simply making a mold on the PPG, which was the gun, the phase plasma gun, and basically once we had the mold, pull out the gun and then pour liquid inside of it to get a solid copy so we could have copies that an actor could drop or fall on and not get hurt. So I would generally say something along the lines of that would probably be, I would say, probably about 2 to 3 days.
Bear, how much give and take was there between you and the art department in terms of they come down with a drawing and you look at it and say, you know, it's going to be hard to manufacture this, but if we change it becomes easier, or they say, no, we really need it to look like this?
To be absolutely 100% honest with you, I've never really had that come down the pike. Basically, all the designs that they came up with Dark Hoffman and Mark Walters and John Acavelli, once they got everything, you know, designed the way they wanted to and it fit into the storyline, they'd hand it over to me, and I was just, I'm such a big fan of the show, I was just jazzed to be building it. So I tried not to turn anything down or try to hurt any designs or anything. But I remember one piece that we did have was right around the time they were doing the, let's see, that was Jakar was on Centauri, and he was getting the laser whip. And at the time, in the story, it was an actual whip on the end of this sort of a lightsaber-looking kind of a handle. And by the time we got on set and Joe took a look at it, he wanted to have something a little bit different with it. And I think that was basically about the only real difficulty we ever really ran into that I can say of.
In terms of making prop, what materials are easier to work with than others?
It depends on the person. A lot of people like sculpting in clay, you know, to make a space helmet and then make a mold on it or something. With me, I like working with foams and metal. Love metal. I don't know what it is. It's one of the things I just really take to heart. Another favorite is wood. But unfortunately, on space, we really didn't get much chance to use wood.
You said you were a science fiction fan growing up. What were your favorite shows as a teenager or a boy?
Well, growing up, obviously Star Trek. And the thing is with the classic Trek, Kirk and Spock style, well, the classic thing with that was I was always not so much interested in the ships or what everybody else was doing. It was the phasers and the communicators that stole my heart. And I just sat there, and I really got to say that deeply affected me. Then, sitting in the theater watching Star Wars opening night and watching that Star Destroyer come overhead, that was the icing on the cake. I knew what I was going to do with my life.
I think that did it for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever watched a different TV show or a movie and looked at a prop and go, you know, I would have made that differently?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's been actually a couple of times my fiance, Dana Ginsburg, we'd be sitting in a movie, and I would say, that looks like rubbish. What are you thinking? You know, there was one episode of Star Trek, Undiscovered Country. The guy was standing there with a translator that he was holding to his ear. And as he's on this big, huge, giant screen, whoever made the props put the power switch directly on the bottom so it's facing camera. And at that, I'm kind of looking and going, well, guys, you could have hit it a little better than that. I know, it's not a criticism thing. It's just you kind of look at it and it's like, well, come on, guys. I don't want to sound like an egomaniac, but...
If you had to choose something from classic sci-fi or a different show, what would be your favorite prop to remake in your own image?
Wow.
Like, if you had the chance just, like, to remake one thing you've seen and go, this is what it should be, what would it be?
There was a series years ago, the classic black and white Outer Limits. There was an episode with Robert Culp called Demon with a Glass Hand.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this plastic hand, for that time, was really difficult to fabricate.
Yes.
I always admired that, and I love that, and I keep telling myself someday I would love to build one to have it. But, I mean, they did such a beautiful job on the first time around. I mean, I could never improve on that. I mean, it was beautiful and deeply, deeply a beautiful piece.
Hey, can I ask a question here?
Absolutely.
There was one of my jobs was to give studio tours to all the VIPs that came through and all that sort of stuff. And unquestionably, the favorite place for every tour was to stop at a place called the Prop Cage. There, tell them about the Prop Cage.
Oh, man. With a name like Bear, it kind of makes you wonder. You know, here they've got a cage where they got to keep props in with a bear. So that alone was just kind of a bad image. But the prop cage, what it was an area that was sealed and locked so we could keep all the props secured. We had the space helmets. We had a lot of the artwork up on the walls. That's where we stored our molds, our supplies to make stuff. And then we had our two cabinets, which had all of our hero stuff in it, the metal PPGs, the metal parts, the really beautiful one-off pieces. And anytime anybody came in, it was always my pleasure to open that up and basically share. It's just the joy that I got out of just showing this to somebody. And we had a couple of kids that would come through, and just to watch their eyes light up to hold, you know, one of the Star Fury helmets or anything else, it just made that job so much more beautiful. And the prop cage was definitely a home to me.
Now, I have to tell you that, you know, for the neophyte, the non-prop maker type, that I would go in there and I would see you had such an assortment of bits and pieces and parts of computers and TVs and model car parts, and I would find some little gizmo and recognize it, and I'd say, oh, look, this is a wheel from a 68 Chevy Camaro, and you would say, oh, no, that's a thermonuclear device, you know.
That's a nuclear induction cap. What are you talking about? One thing that I got to like to throw in, the gentleman that played Marcus, he came by the prop cage one time, and he is quite handy with his hands, and we sat and we talked for a while about this, and we broke for lunch, and there was one of these carriages that had, it was an old VCR that had a lot of wheels and pulleys and things that he could use for the things that he makes. So I left him there with a full VCR, we broke for lunch, went in, ate half an hour. I came back. He had this thing stripped bare. He used the powers of the Rangers, all right. I was truly impressed. And from what I understand, he's used every single piece that he's taken out of that thing. But here is one of the lead actors tearing this thing apart. Was just a riot to watch.
Okay, I believe Tim had a question.
Bear, what props did you get to take home when the show finally wrapped?
I'm thinking about that. A lot of stuff really, there were a few pieces that left, you know, actors like Bruce Boxleitner came in, and I think he wanted the Star Fury model, and I believe he grabbed one of the statues of Jakar, and I think a couple others. I think Joe Straczynski came in, grabbed a couple pieces, but to be honest, what did I get? I've got a lot of the artwork. Mainly the artwork and for designs on stuff and things like that. And then there were a couple of pieces that I brought in from home that basically we modified and then used on the show. and those I have, which is the thruster helmet for Third Space that Bruce Boxleitner wore.
Mm-hmm.
The helmet parts I had sitting in my house, and I just kind of threw them together at work. They approved it, and we ran from there. And the same with the backpack. The backpack was from another film called Life Force, and then we redressed it, put all of our Babylon 5 logos on it, and then shipped it on out.
You worked on Life Force?
No. Actually, I got the Life Force backpack of all places. I was at the Rose Bowl swap meet, and some guy had it sitting there, and he said, $100. I said, done.
Oh, wow.
So, see, prop making the easy way.
Borrow from others.
Yeah. And one thing or two is kind of an interesting little story I'll interject here real quick, if you don't mind. The one thing I really truly enjoyed about Babylon 5 was the fact that when you look at Star Trek, everything was clean, pristine, you know, the Federation top of the line, and you never really got a chance to do anything down and dirty. And with Babylon 5, you could make whatever, you know, whatever the piece is and everything, and you dirty it down to make it look like a real component. And that was the one thing I truly enjoyed, you know, getting away from the spit and polish of Star Trek and then coming over to the grim, or not the grim, but the grimy reality, you know, of life on Babylon 5.
Go ahead, Summer.
I'm waiting to see if Tim has any more questions. He's
Probably a million, but I think that's probably good for tonight.
Alrighty. Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff, if you want to give him the phone number, they can call me anytime. I always love talking about these live.
Awesome.
Oh, we loved having you on our show. Thanks for your time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet you both. Jeffrey, take care, be safe, and take care, folks, and have a good evening.
Okay. You too,
thank you, Bear.
Thank you.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
There's something awkward about writing a promo for a show. Doing the show, no problem. Write an essay, sit down, talk for a bit about what's on my mind, what's new in geekdom, throw out a game review or two, and then read the essay, which of course focuses on a geek topic. NPR wouldn't run it because they're too good. Not that I'm bitter. But the promo, that's the tricky thing. See, that's the time when you have to say, hey, listen to my podcast that's about half an hour long, has me talking geek to you, and ends with an essay that's also about geeky stuff. It's called Geek Fu Action Grip. People seem to like it, it's been around for several months, and there's no sign of it stopping. It's in the Podcast Pickle Hall of Fame and a proud member of the Sci-Fi Podcast Network. You can find it at www.geekfuactiongrip.com. And I don't know how to just come out and say that. I'll let you know if I come up with something.
Hey everyone, this is George Starcher. I wanted to say thanks for making this Babylon podcast. I watched the show ever since it came out on TV, up to when the DVDs came out, and I was running to the store the day they would come out and get them and just marathon watch them all weekend. Love the show, miss it a whole lot. But I wanted to tell you, you know, you were talking about how some of the Star Trek people didn't like Babylon 5. Story and plot consistency envy, maybe? Probably. But anyway, back in September 1996, I was in college in Huntsville, Alabama, and they were holding the 30th anniversary Star Trek convention. A couple of my friends are big Star Trek people, and they came with a huge group up to Huntsville to see the convention. So I went to eat dinner with them and went down to the Kettle. It's kind of like a Shoney's. And they had this huge group there. Just a couple of them were my friends, hanging out with them, talking. And some girl decides she's going to get her little camera and run around and record people talking. You know, why do you like Star Trek? How much fun are you having? All this. Looked at her and said, do not point that camera at me. Kept talking to my friends. Next thing I know, she's pointing the camera at me. So what do? I look at her, jump up from the table and yell, long live Babylon 5! So keep up the podcast, folks. Love it. See ya.
All right. That's thank you, George, for that message. And yes, I've heard many, many Trek B5 fan encounters over the years. Tim, do you have any?
What I'd like to know is if George got out of that restaurant. You know, frankly, I don't. By the time
Babylon 5 rolled around, I wasn't necessarily hanging with a particularly geeky crowd. I introduced two or three people to the show, not heard of it, around second year. But for the most part, what I heard of the animosity was mostly online.
Anything in particular stick out?
Yeah, no.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and read the fan letter we got?
Okay, well, it's not so much a fan letter. We got a post up on the blog from a person running a blog called Solar Flare. I'm guessing it's English, because there's a lot of references to series as opposed to seasons. The person's name is Eoghan, or Eoghan, the name is spelled E-O-G-H-A-N-N. Anyways, what was interesting is they, kind of poking around the blog, they had the personal top 10 favorite list of science fiction shows. Babylon 5 came in number 2. Doctor Who came in at number 1, which also lends to the British theory, as it were. But there was a post left by somebody else, a person named Andrew, and he had this comment about Babylon 5, which I found is very interesting. And this is not the owner of the blog posting this. This was someone posting his response, but here it is. He says, the problem for any show which tries to have an arc is ensuring that the cast buy in and indeed are bought in. Michael O'Hare left and was replaced by Brooks Boxleitner, which resulted in some creative amendments to the story arc, which made the arc difficult to follow. Given that the 5-year arc was the whole point of the series, it was short-sighted not to contract the cast for that many series. I'd like to think this was down to budgetary restrictions, but I can't help thinking that lack of experience and naivety also played their part. I appreciate that a 5-year rolling contract is expensive, but it would have been only been required for 2 or 3 key actors in order to have made the show, the whole series, much easier to follow. I wish Jeffrey was here with us to hear this, because I'm sure he'd have some wonderful things to say about it. But without really trying to give Andrew a hard time, I think the attitude that I sense here is that because there was 5 years, it almost makes it fait accompli that it was predetermined that there was going to be 5 years. And of mm-hmm. course, as anyone who's been following the background of the show knows, that it was a year-to-year affair. And of course, at the beginning of year 4, they told that was it, wrap it all up.
Mm-hmm. And but, I don't think he was correct in his statement that Michael O'Hare left. I thought that was a creative change, where they needed a stronger character to be the commander of the station, which is why they brought in Bruce Boxleitner.
I've heard 2 or 3 different tales about that. One of JMS's commentaries on one of the DVD sets indicates that he saw the story going in a different direction, which meant that the Sinclair character would have become a little more background, and simultaneously that Michael O'Hare wanted to leave to do some stage performance work. So it was an amicable parting. I've also heard that the Warner Brothers people came at the end of year 1 and said that O'Hare's not working and we want somebody who's got a little more star presence and a character that's got a much more forcible command presence. And Straczynski went back and looked at it and said, well, you know, the way the story's going, it would work to write this one character out and bring in a new one. As with all things, you know, understanding is a 3-edged sword and the truth lies somewhere in between. So for what that's worth.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I also know that, they like you said earlier, they weren't sure they were going to get 5 seasons. Everybody had pretty much given up hope after the 4th season, and it took them a while to sign everybody back up for the 5th season, which is one reason why Claudia Christian's not there.
Exactly. And the other comment that he makes in there about the arc becoming difficult to follow, that they because they changed characters, that one eludes me altogether because I think it's extremely easy to see how the story goes. And even with the creative changes that are brought in because of departure of Sinclair in favor of Sheridan, I think all that works. The only cast change that I thought was abrupt and clunky was the departure of Talia Winters and the return of Lita Alexander. That one, more than any other creative change due to cast change, that one was the one that I think was the most contrived.
It might have been. I thought it was sudden that turn of events, but the certain other things that opened up later was kind of interesting. Where I forget which episode it is, but where Bester tries to bait Garibaldi by saying, you know, by letting slip that Talia was dissected.
The messages from Earth. I was just watching that. Yeah. No, I think that, you know, in the aftermath, things were written quite well, but that sudden departure of Talia, her whole arc was heading in one direction,
mm-hmm.
and then it suddenly goes in this whole other direction. And given that one of the selling points for Babylon 5, shall we say, is that all these moments build up over time to bring you to a certain point and a certain culmination of events. This was one where all the events were leading in one direction, and then all of a sudden it goes in a whole completely different way. And that's what felt contrived to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, one last comment. I think the splitting, like having a new commander come in, actually cleared up an arc for me, but we can talk about that later.
Absolutely.
we have plenty to talk about. We don't need to talk about it all in one show. So fans and listeners, if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. The phone number is area code 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
Yes, it did. And
or you could do as George did and record a message for us in an MP3 format and email it to us.
That you can. Probably be cleaner than the voicemail number, but for everybody who doesn't have a headset and microphone to record at home, pick your options. All right. That's it for this week. We will be back next week with a long discussion of The Gathering.
Exactly. Looking forward to it, Summer.
See you then.